Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And for a lot of listeners, I think our next guest's name will sound familiar to you. It's Jason Steed. Jason is an appellate lawyer in Dallas at Kilpatrick, Stockton, and Townsend. Did I get that right, Jason?
Patrick, Townsend, and Stockton.
Sorry.
That's all right.
And a lot of you who are on appellate Twitter, Jason's very active, and I'm sure that you've seen and heard from him over the years. He's also a very active CLE speaker on a lot of different appellate topics. But Jason, for those of us that don't know too much about you, can you kind of just tell us a little bit about your background, kind of who you are, where you're from, that kind of thing?
Sure. First, thanks for having me. I grew up in Oregon, came to Texas for law school at the University of Texas in Austin, and have been in Texas ever since. My wife and I were just talking about this. We've now lived in Texas just slightly more than the number of years we lived in Oregon growing up. So that's kind of weird. I'm an appellate lawyer at Kilpatrick, Townsend, and Stockton.
I mean, you kind of have an interesting background because you didn't necessarily go the straight path through college on to law school and then start practicing law. Can you kind of just tell us about your path to practicing law and appellate law and how you got where you are now? Because you took an interesting route.
Yeah. So I came out of high school with the sort of vague idea that maybe I'd go to law school. I've been, well, those who are familiar with my Twitter account, particularly over the last few years, know that I've been somewhat politically interested or politically active. And I've been that way since high school. I came out of high school with this vague idea that I'd major in political science and go to law school to be, you know, like an environmental lawyer or some other kind of issue or movement-based kind of practice or something like that. And then I quickly thought that I didn't want to be a lawyer, actually. Thought I would hate law school. I thought it would be a bunch of like black and white rules that you had to memorize and stuff like that. And I really liked reading and writing and literature, so I switched and became an English major and wanted to be an English professor and got a master's of fine arts in creative writing, published a bunch of short stories and some poems and was going to write novels or something, and also went and got a PhD in American literature and basically just thought I would teach in an English department and write books for the rest of my life and was pretty happy with that. I changed course, depending on who you ask, it was one of two reasons. If you asked me, it was because being an English professor meant you can't choose where to live. You kind of have to go wherever the English department jobs are. You're pretty limited on cities. In any given year, you know, it's whatever positions are open at certain schools in certain cities. And so you just really have, you're very limited on your choices of just where to go. So that was the main reason for me. I had a job offer in New York City and trying to take, at that time we had three kids, and trying to take three kids to New York City on an English professor salary was just not doable. And that was really the only good offer I had. At that time, there were about 300 English PhDs for every one tenure track position that was available.
Worse than lawyers.
Yeah. It's pretty bad. So anyway, I started thinking about doing something different. If you ask my wife, I didn't make any money as an English professor. And it was about time to start making a little more. You know, they pay you like in highlighter pens and pads of paper and stuff like that. So anyway, yeah, I just decided, well, maybe I'll look into law school after all. And applied, went to law school, loved it. It's basically the same thing I was doing before. You know, before I was, as an English professor, I was reading poems or short stories or plays and trying to figure out, you know, doing close readings, basically, you know, interpreting language, textual interpretation, but it was poems and short stories and plays and stuff like that. And now it's just statutes and contracts and constitutional provisions, but I'm still trying to tell you what this text means. Only now people actually read the stuff that I write and I get paid for it, you know, more than in highlighter pens and pads of paper. So it's worked out pretty well.
So UT Law is what brought you to Texas then?
Yeah. Real quick, I got a story about it. As I mentioned, not being able to choose where to live was like a big problem as an English professor. So when I decided to go to law school, when we decided that's what we were going to do, my wife and I came up with our own, I created this Excel sheet that was our own personalized law school ranking system. So we created all these columns for the things that mattered to us and, you know, cost of living and the size of the town or city, what the job market might look like. We eliminated all big city. We didn't want to, I just had turned down a job in New York. So we didn't want to go to New York or DC or LA or Chicago or, you know, any of the big cities. Well, that eliminates a lot of the top law schools, you know, but we wanted to go to a top law school to have a degree that would travel, you know, so that if we wanted to go, say back to Oregon or wherever we ended up wanting to go, I would have a degree from a school that would get me jobs just about anywhere I went. So anyway, went through this whole ranking system and it came down to, I mean, basically UT was at the top because it was sort of a, not a big city, but still had a legal market. So if he didn't want to move after law school, we could maybe just stay in Austin and fairly decent cost of living at the time. And anyway, that's what brought us here is, you know, we saw, hey, Austin looks good. Let's go. We loved it. Never wanted to leave. And then, job stuff happened and we ended up in Dallas.
Oh, yeah. You practiced here in Austin for a while though, if I remember.
Yeah. Well, including law school, we were there for almost 8 years, I think. So it was about almost 5 years after law school. I was at Akin Gump there in Austin. And then the Austin office was shrinking and it was also kind of in the wake of economic hard times and stuff like that. The Austin job market was pretty terrible, which was part of why the Austin office of Akin Gump was shrinking. It's now gone. They don't have an office in Austin anymore. So it was sort of in those circumstances that I moved up to Dallas.
When you came out of law school, did you know you kind of had an interest in doing appellate law or did it kind of find you once you got into the practice itself?
No, I knew like first year law school, I figured out, you know, research and writing, it was the most academic of any practice area. And so I just wanted to keep doing what I was doing. And really, I pretty much do what I did as an English professor minus the teaching. And that's why I go do as many of the CLE presentations as I can do, because that's sort of how I get my teaching fix.
Attorneys are always trying to figure out the best, most efficient ways to stay on top of their game. Use QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge, a first of its kind intelligent document analysis tool, to discover a new level of confidence. Simply upload a brief, yours or your opponent's, and in just minutes, receive a report with warnings for cited authority, recommendations for additional relevant authority, as well as authority that is contrary to what your opponent cited. Improve the quality and thoroughness of your work without sacrificing time with QuickCheck on Westlaw Edge. I've noticed that you still show up here in Austin, or at least before the pandemic, pretty regularly. And I've noticed too, on that same topic, that one of your areas of interest seems to be United States Supreme Court case law and practice. So how did you get interested in that?
That really just started in law school too. It's the Supreme Court opinions that you're reading mostly in a lot of your coursework. And then my political interests also sort of dovetailed with, you know, the politics of the court and appointment controversies and just all that kind of stuff. It's been an interest really since that first semester of law school. And I came out, I didn't clerk because I was older. I mean, I started law school at 34 and we had four kids. Well, we had our fourth while I was in law school. And then we had number five just after law school. And I just couldn't, you know, the whole point of leaving academia was to try to settle down somewhere, not keep hopping around from city to city. And so moving somewhere for a 1 year clerkship and then trying to move somewhere else after that, or it just wasn't an option. And so I didn't clerk, but I knew immediately I wanted to do appellate stuff and, you know, Supreme Court stuff if possible. So I was, you know, Tom Goldstein was at Akin Gump and he was the one who sort of pioneered the whole, you know, search for circuit splits or other cert-worthy issues and try to get cases before the court sort of strategically. So, I mean, I just hopped right into that right out of law school and, you know, was trying to find a good cert-worthy case that I could try to get up to the court and was involved in a lot of petitions and other stuff for a while. And then I kind of got too busy with just regular practice to keep pursuing that so fervently, but I still follow the court. And so, yeah, it's always been an interest. And the Supreme Court review is basically that's the CLE presentation I give most often.
What kind of practice do you do now? Is it just kind of a general civil practice on the appellate side, or are there things that you kind of specialize in?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much everything, anything and everything. But I feel like at first, for the first several years, I was involved in a lot of class action stuff. That seemed to be a pretty dominant area. It's always been a fairly good split between federal and state appellate work. But maybe lately, it seems like I've been in a lot more state courts. A lot of, Kilpatrick. I joined Kilpatrick about 3 years ago, and they have a pretty strong Native American law practice. And so I've been involved in a number of those cases. So that's become kind of a newer practice area, I guess, for me. And then also a lot more with like patent IP related issues at Kilpatrick, which is another big practice area for Kilpatrick. And so those two areas are a little newer to me, and kind of, you know, there's a little emphasis in those practice areas, but really still it's anything and everything. And the state court stuff is, you know, a lot of contract disputes. And then probably over the last year or two, a lot of property disputes that I've been handling.
There was a merger a few years back, wasn't there, that basically Kilpatrick, the current version of it, is what emerged from. It was a merger of a couple of really large firms, as I remember.
Yeah, there was and I'm not going to be super well-versed in the history of the firm, but it was 10, 15 years ago or something like that. The Atlanta-based Kilpatrick firm merged with the Townsend & Townsend West Coast IP firm, and that sort of formed the firm as it is now. And then they moved into Texas. The Dallas office, I think, opened, I'm going to say maybe it's 5 years ago now. And the Houston office was, you know, maybe three-ish years ago. So it's still a fairly new firm to Texas, but a big nationwide, well, international really, law firm that just isn't super well known to Texas because it's still relatively new here.
Definitely wanted to talk to you about legal writing. You come to legal writing from kind of an interesting background with more of a creative writing literature course of study before you went to law school. How does that experience and education impact the way that you do your legal writing? Do you feel like you do it differently because of that?
Well, I mean, I'll tell you first, I mean, I had sort of two modes of writing. You know, I had the creative writing background and did a lot of that, but I also was this sort of, you know, academic literary scholar mode of writing that, you know, was full of semicolons and really long paragraphs and, you know, stuff like that. And I got to law school and I just assumed, particularly because you read a lot of old Supreme Court opinions, so they have that kind of archaic language and can sometimes be really actually not very well written in legal writing terms. My worst grade my first semester was my legal writing grade because I was trying to write like an academic, and it was just so complex and convoluted. And it took me a semester to get that actually the mode of writing I needed to tap into more was the creative writing side and try to be much more simple and direct. And really probably the biggest thing that I do that I don't know if it's different from anybody else, but maybe I just have I was a little deeper into it before coming into the practice of law than other people maybe. But that sense of narrative or storytelling for particularly the statement of facts, that's like a huge influence for me. Trying to tell that story in a really compelling, clear way that, you know, really trying to have an effect on the reader, because you got a reader who you want to affect. And so that's probably the biggest thing for me is making that shift into away from academic writing, you know, through the law school experience, and then practice really trying to tap more into the narrative storytelling side of the law. And even when you're not statement of facts, you know, even when you're just making a legal argument, there's a certain storytelling quality to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever have to wrangle with trial counsel about the facts that are necessary to be included as facts versus the ones that are truly necessary? I mean, it's a pretty common perception, I think.
Yeah.
In legal writing circles, that you should only, you know, tell the court what it needs to know to decide the case. But, you know, in so many cases, there's so much more to the story. So I would think that there'd be some tension between the storyteller and you and the lawyer on that front.
On the first question, yeah, there's a lot of wrangling with trial counsel and clients about what we do and don't need to put into the brief, right? Like, okay, I get that that was really a big deal, you know, in the trial court. Everybody really cared about that a lot, but we don't care about it now, you know? So there is some wrangling about that. But on the second question about tension between the storytelling and the facts that the court needs to know, I'd say no, because I think Chekhov had this sort of famous line, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember word for word, but something about if a gun appears above the mantle, it better appear later in the story. So in other words, you know, in good story writing, in good fiction writing, particularly short story writing, because we're not writing novels in our briefs, right? This is more of a short story. And in good short story writing, no word is unnecessary, right? You're trying to make every word and every detail matter for whatever the effect is you're trying to create. So there's not really any tension with the legal writing, because I'm not putting any fact in there unless there's a reason. The reasons aren't necessarily like this fact might not be relevant to any of the legal arguments, right? But it still might really matter because I'm trying to have an effect on the reader, and you need to know this fact because this might shift the way you see this case, even if it's not relevant to the legal arguments later.
Yeah.
Something happened on January 18th. If that's not relevant to any of the legal arguments, then it's not going to be something that creates an effect, you know?
But it may impact your storytelling approach, which I really like kind of describing it that way. I think that's a great way to put it, especially with the statement of facts, because they can be so dry a lot of times, especially in, you know, your contract disputes. Not a lot of super interesting things go on in some of the contract disputes, but if you can tell it in a way that makes it at least the most interesting and the way to hook your reader into, okay, well, here's what matters about this. Here's why it's important, other than, you know, some people negotiated a document and then they signed it, and then it turns out that what they contemplated didn't happen and something worse happened. You know, I mean, you have to make that in a way that catches their attention and sets it apart from every other contract case that they read.
Yeah. And I think you have to be like, I'm not averse to having a statement of facts that's three paragraphs long and now let's move on, you know? And I think some people feel like, oh, the statement of facts has to, you can't just say, well, they entered into a contract and someone didn't do something, you know?
Right.
You can't just do that. And sometimes, yeah, you can. Like, that's just all that happened. That's all that's relevant. And if the fact section is two paragraphs to say, here's who these people are and here's, you know, they entered into a contract and someone didn't do it. If that's all your fact section is, that's okay. You know, why bore the reader with three more pages of a bunch of detail that doesn't matter to any of the arguments you're making? So,
right. No, I think that's exactly right. And that's a good thing to remember, that it is okay to cut it off. You don't have to have five pages just for the sake of having five pages if it's not really details that make that much difference to the ultimate question that the court's going to have to decide.
Definitely don't need block quotes from the contract in those cases.
Or big, long block quotes of deposition testimony that where there's really just one line.
I think that's exactly right. What about from the teaching side of things? You know, you taught for a while. Does that, having gone through the process of teaching and even now doing CLEs, does that sort of influence the way you tell your story or the way you tell your legal arguments? You know, we had Judge Costa on here not too long ago, and he said the most important job he ever did was teaching elementary school right after college for Teach for America, because for him, that really changed the way that he makes his legal arguments and analyzes things and breaks things down. Do you feel like teaching kind of changed the way that maybe you tell your stories?
I think it affected or has an effect on oral argument presentation for me, you know, trying to figure out how to organize information and present it as clearly as possible to a room full of really smart students who maybe don't know the details about this particular thing, right? So yeah, I mean, I think in oral argument, it's had an impact. There's not a hard line between the teaching and the research and writing and academic side of what I used to do. It's really just trying to convey information, whether it's in person, orally, or in writing, just trying to convey information that's important in the most effective way possible, I guess. So the teaching, you know, I guess it augmented or supplemented the other background I had for, you know, how to try to just present things as clearly, as succinctly. I mean, in teaching, you got 45, 50 minutes to get a bunch of information across. mm-hmm. and hope people who are listening understand you, right? And get it. Right. So I guess, you know, you have to sort of organize and be as clear as possible, anticipate what kinds of questions you might get, that kind of stuff.
Probably does help, you know, in terms of knowing your audience, that, as you say, you're dealing with, in most cases, a panel of three judges who are going to be able to grasp what you say. They're going to understand the law. You're not trying to teach them how to write. Your job is to educate them in a way that's persuasive. And it sounds like that may be how you approach your briefs, is, you know, you're writing to your audience and use the fact that they're at a certain level of understanding, and in most cases are going to have read your stuff before you show up for oral argument, which is probably more than you can say for the average college student.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, it's hard. Like, I think know your audience is extremely important, but it is kind of hard actually to do that, right? Because you don't know, like, the way I would want to know my audience is I want to know who exactly is on my panel when I write this brief. We don't ever know that. No court announces the panel before briefs have been filed, right? So you can know your audience, but only in really kind of generic terms. It's smart people who know some stuff, but you don't know what they really know because you don't know who they are. Exactly.
Especially in federal court.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I think the know your audience is, that's a huge, I guess I hadn't thought about it. That was huge before I went to law school to become a lawyer, in terms of just writing, you know, how to write effectively. And I would teach it in my writing classes about, you know, knowing your audience and trying to target your audience with, you know, using rhetorical tools in ways that target the audience that you're writing to. And I guess I didn't think about it until you guys brought it up, but that's been a big influence on how I've written as a lawyer.
And I guess one kind of advantage that you have with judges, you know, even generalist judges, is at least you kind of had the shared language of the law at a level of understanding that's a little bit higher than maybe you trying to break down some more difficult and esoteric literary concepts for students who maybe don't have that background. You know, it's your job to really unpack those and explain it to them. But with the law, at least you kind of have a shared baseline, maybe, although not the particular issue in your case.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like that you can kind of skip over some of the introductory stuff a lot of times because you can just jump into the more complex stuff without having to explain the base level stuff, maybe.
I think that's right. Although I would also throw in that, like, one of the biggest, I don't know, mistakes or weaknesses maybe that I see in a lot of legal writing is assuming too much about what the judge or the panel is going to understand. I think what you're referring to is on the front end, you know, you don't necessarily have to like lay all the introductory groundwork that you might have to do for someone who doesn't know anything about the law.
Right. Standards of review, the record, the basic concepts that you guys aren't going to have to quarrel with, because the standard of review is what it is. And maybe there's a dispute over that, but they know what you mean when you say it's either abuse of discretion or legal sufficiency, as opposed to what are we talking about here?
Right. And I think that's right. You can sort of assume a certain basic knowledge and only give them what they really need to know. But I think on the back end, what happens is I will read briefs or drafts of briefs where this case says this and this case says this. So, you know, we win. But there's sort of an assumption that the audience gets how those pieces fit together so that you win, right? Like, sometimes you actually really have to spell out why the fact that this case says this means we win. And I think that's missing a lot of times, where you just assume the judge, oh, if the judge sees that, then she's going to get it. Well, no, not necessarily, right? You got to still connect the dot.
Right.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's consistent with what I see a lot, and especially in real specific areas of the law. You know, the law says this, and so we win. Well, if they don't know that area of the law or really understand it, you do have to kind of back up and say, here's kind of where this rule comes from. Here's the reason for it. Here's why it's important here and it drives the outcome. And here's our facts that put us in line with this. Because if you just kind of say, oh, in this area of the law, it's this, and so we win, then you're skipping steps. And especially in areas where people are using a lot of abbreviations and very technical terms, you know, I think that you're very careful to make that extra clear.
Your brief has a glossary. That's a bad sign.
Yeah.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
We're talking about writing for appellate judges, but you know, a lot of us are writing for trial judges too these days. Do you find that your approach changes somewhat when you're talking to a trial judge? I mean, it seems like you can't really assume the same baseline with the trial judge. Just curious about that.
I don't know that I change much about my approach if I'm helping to write a motion for summary judgment versus a, you know, an opening brief at the appellate court. I think my baseline assumption is if you're a judge, regardless of what level you're judging at, you're a smart person who knows some stuff about the law. And, you know, even in Texas where judges are elected and, you know, maybe aren't always the smartest person who knows everything about all the, I mean, I don't think you even have to have a law degree to get elected as a judge in Texas. But if you, you know, you just assume that they are reasonably smart people who know some stuff. And that's kind of my baseline. You know, I sort of set out to explain what I think needs to be explained. You know, even someone who maybe knows a lot about that particular practice area, it still doesn't hurt to sort of, you know, lay the groundwork for what your more technical argument is going to be built on.
I mean, I don't tell too many war stories, and we're trying to feature our guests and their experiences, but I think of the time in the not too distant past when I was in a court in a neighboring county, and county court level judge did not know or understand really what Texas Citizens Participation Act was. Again, going back to the concept of knowing your audience, I mean, we might sort of almost reasonably assume that most trial judges in this state, civil trial judges now, would know what the TCPA does and what it is. But even then, you know, it just goes back to the idea of education. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure what the right approach would be, you know, because I don't think it's unreasonable to think that most of the judges have heard of or even applied the TCPA. But just in terms of, you know, it just comes back to the idea of, you know, basically start with the basic blocks and then build up from there, because you're right. I mean, even though we have mostly elected judiciary, I mean, these people are smart enough to get elected, which means that they've got some level of intelligence. They're, you know, lawyers. But maybe the lesson in that is don't necessarily assume that your judge, you know, knows what you might think to be the baseline. If you're in the trial court, certainly appellate judges, you know, that may be a different story because their timeline is different. You know, most of them have good staff that can help them get up to speed. But just thinking back to that little story, it was really kind of blew me away at the time that there was a trial judge of the state that really hadn't had anything to do with the TCPA.
Right. Right. Well, it's not just state court judges. I mean, we had a federal court case with a federal judge who had never really encountered a statute that the whole case was about. And so, I mean, that's still, it's not the TCPA, right? You would think everybody's pretty much encountered that, but still it wasn't an obscure statute. it was one where you'd think you came across that once in a while. So, I mean, I think you just have to, the danger of knowing your audience is assuming too much and assuming that they know more than they know, because you think you know your audience and that they know stuff and end up assuming they know more than they do. And so you just, I think, you know, assume that they're smart and, you know, you don't have to start with the Constitution was ratified in, you know, but you can lay the basic foundation of, hey, here's what this statute is. Here's what it does. You know, it doesn't really apply to state court, but I still write this way in state court. But I would love for a judge to cut and paste the sort of groundwork portion of the legal argument from my brief into their opinion. The same thing goes for, and you know, a lot of opinions, they'll start out with, here's what this statute is, here's what it does, here's the provision that's at issue. You know, it's that sort of walking through to where we are in this case, you know, here's the sort of groundwork stuff. I'd love it if a judge cuts and pastes that, and I just made their job easier, you know, by letting them paste that stuff into their opinion. State court judges aren't writing opinions at the trial court level, but I'm still going to provide that basic stuff, even if maybe they are kind of familiar with that. That's just, this is how we get to the argument. And don't take more than a couple paragraphs to do it, but, mm-hmm. you know, this is how we get to where we're at in this case. So I think that's worth including.
One area I kind of wanted to touch on that I feel like is a little bit law adjacent, but I know from following you on Twitter is you kind of have an expertise in humor, which is an interesting area to have an expertise in, but it's something that I see more and more judges seem to kind of try and work it into their opinions. And sometimes you see advocates try and work it into their briefing, which I feel like is a very dangerous thing to do. But I'm just kind of curious your perspective as you see judges kind of trying to work humor and what I guess you would call creativity into the way that they write their opinions and some of the footnotes and references and stuff. I just kind of wanted to get your take on it as someone who's actually studied humor as part of your education and background.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say I'm a huge fan of humor everywhere but in legal writing.
I understand that.
Yeah. I mean, I would not ever try to be funny. I mean, I guess there's some gray area, right? I mean, there's some ways where you might sort of, you might attempt to, I don't know, be flippant or maybe somewhat snarky, I guess, at times. You know, there's certain things you can do that, yeah, there's kind of an overlap, or maybe that kind of enters into the realm of potential humor or something. The folksiness that some judges sort of write into their opinions, you know, maybe there's a kind of lightheartedness to that, that that's in the gray area overlapping with humor or something. I wouldn't recommend trying to be funny, not in a brief and not in an opinion either, in a judicial opinion. I think trying to be clear, I'm trying to be succinct, trying to be right for a layperson audience. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all great. You know, sometimes some of that might involve a kind of folksiness or a kind of what probably is better described as just informality, right? Which I think is fine and great. But when it's, I'm not a big fan of acute stuff. And I'm definitely not, I would never advocate like trying to be funny, not with legal matters that are always, I mean, these are always serious matters. That's why people are in court, right? It doesn't matter how little it is, or it's not a funny thing. People don't take their time to go to court mm-hmm. to be funny. So I'm not a fan of like judicial opinions that make light of, you know, serious situations. And you'll see that like even like in a criminal sentencing case or, you know, and it's just like, I don't know, really tone deaf.
Seems like we're seeing less formality in a lot of, even before the circuit courts, seemingly quite as much in the state appellate courts. But of course, there's been a lot of highly publicized opinions recently. But it seems like we're seeing a lot less formality and maybe a few more literary references, which, you know, go right over my head most of the time. Because I'm doing good just to, you know, try to string two sentences together most of the time. But I wonder, you know, I feel like you might have an opinion about the use of literary references as sort of parallels or logical parallels, which we have seen with some increasing frequency and even in state court appellate opinions. What do you think?
I mean, I like creativity. I like informality. I think informality is great. I'd love to see more contractions and a sort of just common speak type language. I think the more accessible judicial opinions are to just everyday reader is good. I think the literary allusions or other things like that, that's all good. I think, you know, there's a line somewhere. It's probably hard to identify where the line is. There's a line somewhere, in my opinion, where you're just showing off. like that's not actually accomplishing. Like, I think going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think everything should serve a real purpose, right? In legal writing. And that goes for the judicial opinion writing as well as the brief writing. Like, if there's a gun over the mantle, it better come up later. You know, same thing goes for a literary reference. If an allusion to Huck Finn gets you somewhere, it helps to make a point, or it, you know, it furthers the narrative in some way. I don't know. It creates a, there's a certain tone or a certain effect that you're trying to create for the reader, and this is part of it, then that's all great. But if you're showing off, or I don't know, there's a line. There's a line somewhere. And I think sometimes it gets crossed. I don't like, you know, some of the folksy or creativity kind of stuff or the informality. Some of it is snarky. And I think there are situations where lawyers deserve to be chastised for something that they're doing. I don't think courts do that enough, actually. I think there's a lot of crap that lawyers do that they ought to get chastised and sanctioned more often for. But I don't think snarkiness is the way to do it. Like, just say it, you know, just say, this is inappropriate. Don't do that. And if applicable, here's the sanction amount for what you did, you know, but the kind of cutesy, snarky, that kind of stuff, that starts feeling like you're writing an op-ed rather than a serious legal opinion. But it is really hard to say where the line is sometimes.
Well, there's the element of a power imbalance that kind of adds to it. too, that, you know, even if maybe it wasn't truly intended to be snarky, it sometimes just reads that way based on the relative positions of the people there. Or I think the same thing with humor, something that might be funny going in a different direction, when it's coming kind of punching down, it definitely takes some of that effect out.
Right. And that, I think, is the risk with judicial opinions. Almost by nature, you are always punching down if you're punching, mm-hmm. because you're the judge. So yeah, I agree with that.
To being someone who at first was really struck when I started seeing contractions in formal legal writing, and then, you know, periodically they would start showing up in judicial opinions. And the old school, you know, educated in the 90s, you know, law school kind of conservative part of me was like, oh, don't do that. But then as we've gone along, and we've seen some of these other things happen in legal writing, you know, I'm starting to see that at times, you know, in the right setting, they can be effective. And so it's interesting to see over the last 25 years or so how legal writing generally has changed, not just the way that they teach legal writing in the law schools, which we've talked about here on the show before too, but, you know, how it's being implemented. Because I always thought, well, we want to maintain as a legal writer, we want to maintain a certain level of formality just as a matter of decorum and respect for the court. And I would still subscribe to that view, but I think I've come around, for what it's worth, to the occasional use of a contraction when I think it helps make my point.
The biggest thing about contractions is the misconception that they're informal. I mean, you just said it, and that's what like 97% of people believe, is that they're informal, and they're not. Contractions have been around forever, and they're not a part of formal writing. I gathered at one point a bunch of examples of contractions in judicial opinions going back, 100 years ago, there were contractions in judicial opinions, U.S. Supreme Court opinions. They're not super common, but they're there. And if I recall correctly, I think there's even a contraction in the Constitution somewhere. Maybe it's the Declaration of Independence. One of those founding documents, I think there's a contraction in one of them. It's not the sort of informal, slangy kind of thing that people tend to think it is. It's a part of writing. And for me, rhythm is really important in writing. You know, how does that sentence sound in my head? And when I string these sentences together, is there a certain, I don't know, rhythm or feel to how those sentences I read out loud when I'm editing? I want it to sound right. And sometimes you can't get that rhythm to sound right without the contraction. It ends up sounding stilted and overly, I'm going to say formal.
Supporting the exception. Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with contractions. I'm a big advocate of contractions. I probably, one of my tics, you know, we all have tics that we, in our editing process, we have to reduce the number of times that we do that. Three of my tics are a lot of M dashes, a lot of contractions, and a lot of sentences starting with and. And I have cut those out, a lot of those out, because I overuse those three things. But I think contractions are a very good way to get the sentence right.
One other area we kind of wanted to talk to you about is social media and Twitter. I think the way I got to know of you was on Twitter, and you have a big Twitter following. You're very active on there, I think, both from the legal side and then from the political side. How did you get involved in that?
Well, I don't remember why. I think I just heard about this thing called Twitter, and I tried to get on it and figure out what is this. And I think I was in law school. I think I was maybe a third year law student. I don't remember, but I just got on to try to figure out what it was. I actually set up a couple accounts. I set up like a Texas Appeals account and then the Fifth Circuit Appeals account. And my plan was just, I'm just going to like tweet out interesting decisions from these courts. And at first, that's kind of all I did from a couple different accounts. And I think I actually had like three or four accounts, and a couple of them were like practice area focused. I was just going to like interesting opinions that came out in a practice area or something. So that's kind of how I started on Twitter, is I just thought it would be that, I would just tweet out interesting opinions. And then it evolved into, you know, the whole appellate Twitter legal writing kind of community with discussing, I think at first it was mostly legal writing stuff, you know, discussing one space or two spaces, you know, arguing at length over things like that. That's really what it was then for a few years, was just appellate practice, legal writing, Supreme Court kind of stuff. I whittled down my accounts to just the one account that I have now. And I have always been politically interested and active, but kept that very far away from Twitter. That's what Facebook was for a while. And then the whole Trump thing started happening in 2016. And I just kind of felt like I can't not say anything about what's going on here. And I know there will be some listeners who disagree, I guess, but to me, I saw very early in 2016, this is horrible and really bad. And somebody needs to say something about how bad this is. I can't not say anything about how bad I think this is. And then that's when, you know, I only had, I don't know, 1,000 or 2,000 followers who were all lawyers in the legal writing appellate Twitter community. You know, I wrote that thread about the humor stuff in direct response to joking comment that Trump had made during the 2016 campaign. And I wrote that thread about joking and humor. And so you mentioned I have a bunch of followers, but you know, most of those are people who became my follower after reading that thread. And then I've gained some more followers because of the political comments and stuff that I've made. But I'm very quickly weaning myself away from all of that right now, because now that, I mean, I don't think he's going away, but he's at least not in office, not going to be in office anymore. So I feel less need to politicize my Twitter account now. And hopefully, I don't know if I'll lose thousands upon thousands of followers once my Twitter account is fully returned to one space versus two spaces and things like that. But that's where it's headed, for the, you know, fair warning to everybody who's out there. That's where it's headed quickly. So
expect a lot more font discussions than
politics. Yeah. Let's talk fonts and punctuation marks and other things, because I really don't want to talk about the other stuff anymore. I'm tired of it.
Well, we're happy to see you on Twitter and to follow you. And I learned something. You're one of the people, Jason, that I definitely learn things from based on Twitter, not specifically to the political stuff, but there's enough legal writing and appellate advocacy stuff in there still that you've retained the interest of the lawyers. And, you know, if you lose a few followers because of politics, you know, so be it. But in the transition, we can all stand to do with a little less interesting news cycle for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we go, we wanted to make sure and give you the chance we do with all our guests to offer up a specific tip or a war story for the audience. I'm curious, you know, what you might come up with on that.
Thought about this a bit, and I think as appellate lawyers, we don't really have the same opportunity to collect war stories that the trial lawyers have. You know, our war stories are always by nature more boring than any of the war stories that the trial lawyers can come up with.
Objectively so, but not to other appellate lawyers.
Well, okay, maybe so, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know that I have a lot of, and I'm also maybe not the greatest collector of war stories. Things happen that are kind of crazy, but then I just sort of move on and forget about it. So I mean, a tip I would offer, which is, I feel like, I don't know, regretful maybe that I have to offer it, but man, always read the statute, you know, always go and read the text of the thing that you're arguing over. I've come in so many times to help post-judgment motions or appellate matters where all the briefing below was just from case law and other stuff, and not really focusing on the language of the actual statute or the language, you know, whatever the language is that's actually at issue. And so there's a lot of like, okay, let's back up. Let's zoom out for a second and just look at the language here so that we can start crafting our argument from that. And my tip is, yeah, just start with where it starts, you know, and read the language that's at issue. Read the provisions of the statute that apply in the case and start from there. I think we very often skip right to case law and other kind of research and stuff that we start digging in and making arguments from all of that. So that's my not very groundbreaking tip, but yet surprisingly needed, I think.
And read the other provisions around it. Section before, the section after, make sure you know the context it sits in.
And those statutory definitions of terms and all those kinds of things.
You bet. I think better than you think it is, Jason, as far as a tip. We could all be reminded of that. Jason, this has been really great. Thanks for being with us today. We sure appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for having me again. Thanks for all the kind words. I appreciate it.
As we wrap up, though, before we go, we'd like to pause for a moment and thank our sponsors, Thomson Reuters and Court Surety Bond Agency. We appreciate their support.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who has rated us so far.
If you have questions, thoughts, or comments, shoot us an email at hosts@techsapplawpod.com. Message us on Twitter or Instagram @TechSapLawPod, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at TexAppLawPod.com or on Twitter @TexAppLawPod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.